existing contracts that ODOT has for highway construction. Jessica is, as we speak, in Legislative Council picking up a final set of amendments. And the Department of Transportation has worked on these amendments with them. So they are different than the amendments we had at the hearing. Thank you.
These would be the dash three?
I assume they're going to be the dash threes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That's my understanding as well.
Pardon?
I said that's my understanding as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, they're on the way. Can you speak to them now? Can you tell us what the dash threes do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we haven't seen them yet.
Oh, okay. Well, we're having a hard time spinning our wheels here this morning.
Did you initiate it?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Somebody show up with some amendments here, pretty quick. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2077. Now, third time's a charm. We'll get them. Okay.
Lisa okay, just walk back in. She can tell us what's going on at least.
Lisa, then.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready to go, Lisa? On your.
Right.
Okay. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3319, and finally found something we can talk about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and we're here today to let you know that on House Bill 3319 that we've reached agreement with Boley, and Legislative Council is drafting the amendments. Basically, I'll cover my piece of that bill. My concern was where you get multiple penalties for the same violation. And we've basically come up with a simple concept that one paycheck, one violation. So that language is being drafted. And then there's Paul's piece.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove representing Addis Healthcare. We apologize. We were just down in Legislative Council as you tapped us in, checking on the status of the amendments, and they are being drafted. With respect to the piece I described to the committee, which had to do with people who were working off-site, not turning in their time records, so we didn't know how much to pay, the concept that we've agreed with Boley to draft and is being drafted by Legislative Council provides that if the employer makes an estimate of the wages due when they don't have the time records, and if that estimate is wrong, then they're not subject to a penalty so long as once they get the time records, then they make the correct payment, whatever that turns out to be, within 5 days. So we think that's a fair and reasonable solution to that problem. And we recognize that in some cases, Boley did not interpret these statutes to provide for the unforeseen and complicated results that have been occurring to us in court cases. But we think we've now drafted these so that, in fact, private counsel out there bringing court cases will also be using essentially the same kind of rational evaluation of what's really going on that Boley has been using when it's been looking at these cases. So we think it's a good solution, and we will hopefully have those amendments to you shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ned Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner, for the record. We are pleased to be here today to have reached an agreement on Lisa's issue in regards to the one paycheck, only one penalty. We think it's only fair that if there's multiple violations in one paycheck, that the employer only get one penalty and not more than that just for one paycheck's worth of problems. If there are multiple problems over a series of paychecks, then they will still be subject to multiple penalties for each paycheck problem. And as Mr. Cosgrove said, this is not a Boley issue. We do not interpret the statute or use it in that way, but court cases have sort of had trouble interpreting the current law because it's somewhat convoluted in how it's drafted. So we think this will help the courts and be more instructive on that regard and also protect employees if their employer has a pattern of having paycheck problems in terms of payments. On Mr. Cosgrove's issue, we are pleased that we were able to narrow it. And so employers will not be penalized for a bad guess on estimating the amount of wages they think they're owed. And that seems very fair as well. So we appreciate the opportunity to work with both of them.
Thank you, folks. Any questions? Don't see any. Lisa, you're 3256. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3319 and open the work session on House Bill 3256.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm still Lisa Trussell with AOI. And on House Bill 3256, we've also reached agreement with Boley on that issue. Our concern at the time was the broadness of definition of an employer on a civil proceedings section of 659A-230 had unintended consequences of providing protection to individuals that probably weren't anticipated. After much discussion with Boley, we've come to an agreement that the whistleblowing protection will apply in civil proceedings against an employer that involve a whistleblowing issue. And Legislative Council is drafting that, and they are also drafting language that attempts to describe whistleblowing, what whistleblowing activities would be. And with that, I'll turn it over to Annette.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner. I believe that this is a very good narrowing of the statute to address whistleblowing, but using a broad definition of what whistleblowing is. And it will still cover, as Representative Shields had asked us last time, the ability of someone to come forward and talk about an industry problem, whether it's the Enron or the SNL or some kind of accounting scandal. And that is really, I think, the ability to use the civil process with administrative or go to court remedies and do so without the retaliation problems that you suspect. So I did research other whistleblowing statutes around the country and in some in federal law, and the language that Legislative Council is working on is a result of that language that we found around the country. It also mirrors the one aspect that we do have in the public sector whistleblowing statute now, so there'll be some symmetry to that with this statute, and I believe that it's a good policy result, so we're pleased to be able to support it.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Annette, Lisa, what you're saying is that this would not, or the amendments would not weaken the protections afforded to members of the legal and accounting professions if they decided to blow the whistle on their client?
That's correct, because the bill as drafted initially would be deleted and we would be substituting this amendment. So that initial conversation we had with you about our concern about the chilling effect that the bill as drafted would have, I believe that this eliminates all of that problem because it clearly addresses whistleblowing.
Great. Thanks.
Representative Schaffer.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say thank you for you all working so well together for the betterment of the state of Oregon. It was really nice to see you.
We've known each other a long time, so that helps.
Representative Colby. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not having the amendments in front of us, it's a little difficult to ask questions about it, but I'm curious about the piece where the employee is whistleblowing on an employer, not the employer. What's the status of that? Is the employee going to be limited to whistleblowing on his employer, his or her employer, or can I whistleblow on somebody else's employer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, we maintain that you could whistleblow against another employer and your current employer should not hold that against you. So that aspect is still the same and it's not changed like the bill is drafted.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, we'd be glad to be here when you do actually see the amendments and work it to make sure you have any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa, could you tell us when the, did the council tell you when the amendments would be ready? Okay, sometime this session.
Well, I hope. Okay.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3256 and go back to open a public or work session on House Bill 2077. We've got the amendments now. Everyone get the... There's Jessica here.
Yep.
Jessica, could you please come up?
Mr. Chair.
Hi, Janet.
I guess this is why meetings don't usually start at 8 o'clock. A lot happens between 8 and 8:30 between us and Legislative Council, and so that's why 8 o'clock meetings are a little harder.
Good morning, Jessica.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. In front of you, I believe, is the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2077. The amendment is something that we've been working with ODOT to make sure that we have addressed their concerns and made sure that this new mechanism will work smoothly as it was intended to do. The threshold in this bill mirrors the threshold that's in the oil and fuel escalation clauses, in which event where a contractor, essentially, if the cost goes up 10%, the contractor eats that. That's their risk that you absorb into a contract, and that's what in those clauses that we've worked with ODOT for years on and been in place for a long, long time, that's how that structure works. And then anything above 10% is reimbursable, and the price gets adjusted for that. What the amendment does in Section 2, Sub 2, is say that the contractor or that ODOT, if the contractor asks for an adjustment, will make an adjustment if the contractor demonstrates that the price has increased more than 10%. To do that, the contractor produces the original bid quote and then the invoice and demonstrates what happened there. There is rulemaking authority for ODOT for us to sit down and work with them on the mechanics of making it all work and work properly. We have had a good relationship with ODOT and have been working on the escalation clause itself for quite some time. And believe we'll be able to quickly come up with rules to make this work smoothly.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Gillum, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah, I'll jump in. Jessica, after it's triggered at 10%, anything above 10%, the 0 to 10% is still the contractor's loss. That even though it's triggered, we don't go back and look at that. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Any, Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, I know we've been focusing on our bridge projects and the highway projects, but ODOT. But does this law also apply to other contracting agencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holden, no. The big concern that we've heard from contractors, and we represent contractors that do projects on for all public agencies, the big concern we've heard is the contracts related to ODOT. In large part because contractors who work for ODOT primarily and only work for ODOT. There is some exception. They do some work for smaller agencies. But the for example, Tim Hendricks with Wildish, his company, the bridge unit that he manages and the road unit, ODOT is their primary customer. And so for those folks that found themselves in this position and that have been hard hit by this crisis, ODOT is the focus because that is their primary client.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. But I would think this would be a concern amongst other contractors that have steel, you know, construction in their buildings as well for the state or school districts or so, but that hasn't really surfaced as a huge issue with them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, no, it has not, at least not that we have heard directly, and it may be that those contracts contain different specifications that would allow for an adjustment for this commodity increase or for these circumstances. It is because the ODOT contract does not allow, and because of our lengthy work on trying to make it happen, that's why we're here with this language. We have not heard similar concerns from it, and certainly have the kind of experience with other contract language that we have with you.
Thank you.
Representative Vesco.
How do you determine that this has gone up 10%? Do they have to provide an invoice from their supplier, or how does this work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, that's exactly how we anticipate we will need to provide that burden. Contractors, as I'm sure you know, keep long records of all of the quotes that they received, and then in that same bid file, keep records of the invoices when they come in, and they're pretty specific in the amount of the material cost and what that looks like against the amount of what was there in their quote. especially if it's on a unit price system or other very specific bid item. So they will be able to take their bid quote and take the invoice and put those together in a way that will be able to demonstrate that increase.
Follow up. The other question I have, of course, you have to look at both sides of any issue. Could this be used as a leverage tool to get a bid by underbidding your steel and then coming back in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, we don't anticipate that being an issue, in large part because by the time this bill is signed and into law, we anticipate being literally weeks away from instituting the steel escalation clause in rule in contracts. So contracts moving forward from that point, you wouldn't be able to claim the 10% adjustment under this bid. On future bids, you'll have the steel escalation clause in place, and this remedy would not apply because the bill in section 2 sub 4 on line 7 of page 2 of the amendment says once a steel escalation clause is in place, the remedies provided under these sections no longer apply to you. So moving forward, a contractor won't be able to take advantage of this remedy, undercut their price, and then
add it on them back.
Yeah, okay. This is gonna help current contracts.
Any other questions, Jessica? Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. I think it's John.
John Jackley.
How do they look there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're comfortable with them.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I need. The chair would entertain a motion to adopt the dash threes. Representative Escobar moves that we adopt the dash threes to House Bill 2077. Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Escobar.
I'll move that we send 2077, I think it's to the House floor, as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2077 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? This bill will have a fairly sizable physical that will need to be explained on the floor at that time because we're not going to Ways and Means. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative
Rustwell.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kidd.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative Ditchfield.
Aye.
Chair Brown. Aye. Motion carried. Okay, Representative Rustwell will carry the bill on the floor for us. Okay, now we're down to where, Janet?
First hearing.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2669.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have someone listening in on the phone.
He's going to be testifying.
Okay. Could I have Paul Romain, please? Morning, Paul.
Morning. Do you want me to wait till
when we get that person on the phone? Okay.
Thank you for calling McHale Group. Leave a detailed message. I'll get back to you.
Record your message after the tone. To send a numeric page, press 5.
I'll leave a message.
When you are finished recording, hang up, or for delivery options, press 9.
Mr. McHale, this is Janet Adkins, and we will call back in about 5 minutes. Thank you.
Go ahead, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. With me is Molly Brady, who is with First Call Heating and Cooling Systems in, I think I got the name right, but it was close enough, in Portland. And we are in support of a modified version of House Bill 2669. The modified version is the dash three amendments that I believe you have in front of you. And let me explain.
Janet, I left Janet out of the action here and let her have the opportunity to explain
want
the bill.
I Janet out of the action either. No. I will defer. I'm going to be quiet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After your summary, there's two amendments. Mr. Romaine is going to talk about the dash three amendments. And the dash three amendments replace the bill. They do, unlike the original bill and the amendments that you'll hear from Mr. McHale on the phone, they do maintain state regulation of service contracts that are sold to businesses as well as to homeowners. And they apply different, conditions to sellers of home service agreements, making it easier for a person to sell, for a person or business to sell home service agreements to individual homeowners. It allows them to meet their financial stability requirements by filing a $25,000 surety bond. It requires the bond companies to notify DCBS 30 days prior to cancellation of the bond, and provides consumer rights of action under the bond. It will apply to service contracts entered into or after January 1st, 2006. And we also have people from the insurance division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services to explain if you have any questions about the requirement. Just a little preview of the Dash 2 amendments, and those are for Mr. McHale that we'll try to reach by phone again. They exempt from state regulation, as the original bill does, service contracts that are sold to businesses. So it maintains state regulation for service agreements sold to individuals for homes, but not for businesses for business properties. So that would be the change under the Dash 2 amendments, a larger change than Mr. Romaine is talking about. And the only thing the Dash 2 amendments do of Mr. McHale's is clarify that the consideration is the greater of $25,000 or 5% instead of the lesser of the two. So that's just a clarification. But he really, Mr. McHale is supporting the original bill, again, which removes state regulation of commercial sales of service agreements. So if you're confused, I don't blame you. And Mr. Romaine might be able to help.
Thank you. Well,
Mr. Chair, by the time I'm finished, you will all be enlightened. Hold hands and walk out together. Let me read something to you, and it's in the existing law right now under service contracts. It's actually the Section 1 of the bill that's in front of you, which under our amendments stays. We're just not changing it at all. But what the statute was designed to do was to create a legal framework within which service contracts may be sold in the state to encourage innovation in the marketing and development of more economical and effective means of providing services under service contracts while placing the risk of innovation on the obligors rather than on the consumers, and also to permit and encourage fair and effective competition in the business, basically. What happened is, if you look at how service contracts now are handled, and again, warranties and maintenance agreements are not covered, but service agreements, for example, particular to our particular business, your heating and cooling system, Christmas Eve, conks out, and you need somebody to come out and repair it, basically. That's what we're talking about, that kind of agreement on your home. What happens right now is under existing law, you can be in that service contract business if you are a huge company, which is basically the $100 million company. It's the Sears exemption that was probably in the original law, which I would actually argue is probably the least consumer protection nowadays if you look at the big companies going out of business, or if you're a subsidiary of a big business. Or the third way was a purchase of a reimbursement insurance policy. The problem with that is that the reimbursement insurance policies were so expensive and rightly so, that you could never get that kind of insurance. So either people went bare and did these contracts, which was illegal, or they just didn't do the contracts. And it is a consumer benefit. So basically what we did was we drafted up some legislation, 2669, or at least had it drafted up. And then we started talking to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and they were wonderful in this process. I want to praise them upside down and backwards. They worked with us to try and craft solutions. They were not obstacles in this. They worked. They actually helped us try and craft something. And they are neutral on our particular amendments. They take no position on our amendments. They do oppose what Mr. McHale was trying to do, and I'll explain the differences. What Mr. McHale is trying to do with the Dash 2 amendments is basically exempt business contracts and cover, in a little different way, home agreements. In other words, there would be no regulation of business service contracts. So a school district, a big building, or anything else, those kind of things, you would be exempt from state regulation or no consumer protection. The business wouldn't have any consumer protection. We don't oppose that. Obviously, we're in the business, and the less amount of government regulation, the better. But that does provide less amount of consumer protection, obviously, if there's no regulation. And that's also opposed directly by the department. And so we do not want to get crosswise with the department, so we do not ask you, or we are not asking you, to do the Dash 2 amendments. What the Dash 3 amendments do is set up another way to basically be in the service contract business. And they cover specifically home service agreements as defined currently in law, and those are basically contracts on your roof, your things that are in your house, your heating and cooling systems, that kind of stuff, which is defined in 731-164. That's already defined in law. And what we do is set up a $25,000 surety bond. So what it does is allow people to actually get into the business, do the work, have consumer protection out there. We feel it's the best of all worlds, and we would ask you basically to take 2669, adopt the Dash 3 amendments, and pass the bill. Again, these are contracts that probably exist out there. In fact, that's sort of how it came to our attention. We were kind of looking at this stuff, and what we realized was there's probably a lot of people that are doing things out there with no consumer protection because they're not getting that insurance policy, which is very expensive or very difficult to get. So we need to set up some way to allow for these contracts, allow for the good that the contracts do. Basically, you have somebody who is obligated to come to repair your furnace. You don't have to be calling around on different times to find somebody and provide that consumer protection. Now, Molly will be more than happy to answer any questions, and I would too, and we would ask for your support of the Dash 3 amendments.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Romaine. I think we may have what's a fundamental disagreement about that role of government. I'm glad our home is protected, and it sounds like your Dash 3 will protect my wife's business because she's an expert at what she does, but she's not an expert at heating and cooling. And there's thousands of businesses out there that aren't either. So your amendments will still protect small business folks who don't have a team of lawyers and accountants to watch out for them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we, being a lawyer, we actually like them to rely upon lawyers more than they do, and normally I would do anything to further that, but in this instance, you're absolutely correct. What we do is say, look, if you're a huge company like Nike and you can negotiate a great contract and you can basically handle your stuff, that's fine, but there's a lot of small businesses out there that really are pretty much in the same position that a homeowner is.
Right.
We do not exempt those contracts. They're subject to state regulation. They're covered. We're not trying to get to do anything different with those folks.
Okay.
Our business, the stuff most of our folks are involved in, are simply the repair of your heating and air conditioning system at home, and that's what we're trying to make this thing, which really is available in the marketplace, but make sure it's at least covered and allow people to get in the business.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Jenna?
I just wanted to point out, because it might be confusing to you, that the original bill did, your original bill did exempt all commercial from regulation as well. And that's why the dash two amendments only make a slight change and are supported by Mr. McKay.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the original bill was the product of us handing a concept to legislative council, and that's what came out. We really didn't ever think about, we were concerned about making sure we could do the home service agreements. It just sort of came out in this package, because what they did is took Washington law and brought it down to Oregon. And Washington does exempt the commercial contracts.
Any other questions, Paul? Thank you.
Thank you.
Janet, you want to try to make connection again? Molly, did you have anything?
No.
No? Okay. Can I have Michael Mortier and Carl Lundberg?
Hi, Mr. McHale. This is Janet Adkins. And
Hi, Janet. How are you?
Fine. We're here with a seven-member House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we missed you on our first call. Just to catch you up, Mr. Romaine has explained the Dash 3 amendments, and if you do want to do that.
Mr. McHale, this is Chairman Brown.
And, Chairman, how do you do?
Real good. Why don't we go ahead and first we'll take your testimony on the Dash 2 is what we got you on the phone there.
Could you read that to me? I'm not, I don't have it in front of me. Okay. So just give me the gist of it.
The Dash 2 amendments on page 3 of the printed bill, line 9, delete less and insert greater.
Exactly. Okay.
I guess go ahead with your testimony on the bill, then, if you have some.
Okay, yeah, my testimony in the part there is that there is a flaw in the way the bill had originally been submitted, and that if there was no business sold, there was no money in the account, and I think that the deposit is correct, that it should be the greater of whichever sum, and I would agree with that. There are other things. Did you want to just, should I just continue?
Yes.
Okay. The way HB 2669 was originally written was in essence meant to match the laws of the state of Washington as far as service contracts, and essentially what I was trying to do was to exclude commercial accounts from that and have it protect homeowners, which Washington has done for several years, and they haven't had a problem with it. The reason for that is twofold. One is that it's much more expensive to sell the businesses, and the other is that the state of Washington laws, the way they're written, they work quite well, and I was trying to get an Oregon-based business going that matched the laws so that you could advertise and operate the business in all five northwestern states the same. So that's the essence of where I'm coming from.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McHale. Any questions, committee? I don't see any. Mr. McHale, we have a couple other gentlemen that are going to testify now from DCBS, and so we'll go ahead with them.
Real good. Thank you very much.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think you understand what service contracts are, so I'd like to, and the fact that our law was enacted the way it was in 1995, and we have, it's worked quite well for us since that time. There's really two approaches to amending the current law. The first appearing in the printed bill and the Dash 2 amendment proposes extensive changes and allows another means of ensuring the faithful performance in exempting service contracts on personal tangible property. So the commercial property would be accepted under the from regulation totally on the original bill with the dash two amendments, and it creates a another way of filing financial security with a bonding mechanism, which is fairly complicated and has a lot of different parts to it. The second approach on these amendments is the and the department doesn't really support that position. We don't support changing the regulation of service contracts by exempting commercial transactions and leaving all commercial transactions unregulated. The second approach is the Dash 3 amendments, and you've heard extensively about that, but what they basically do is they take the home service agreements and they allow people who sell home service agreements, which are obligors, to post a bond in a different way, a $25,000 bond. And this bond is has a private right of action attached to it with attorney fees so that consumers will be well protected under that system. And so we don't take a position on that. It's a policy decision on your part on whether you want to go that route, but it doesn't eliminate regulation. And from our point of view, it will provide consumer protection in an adequate way. Are there any particular questions that I could answer?
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Just for the record, when you say consumer, you mean not just homeowners, but small businesses that... Just the same question I asked Mr. Romeo.
Yes, anyone who wrote a home service agreement would have to post a bond in the amount of $25,000, and they would have the protections that were afforded under that bond. If they got, if they were had proof of financial responsibility by having a reimbursement insurance contract, then that would be the mechanism which would protect them. And if they had $100 million or their subsidiaries and promised to carry out, that would be the way that they would be protected.
Just so I can clarify.
Follow up.
What about just a small business person? They're protected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffer, yes, they're protected by the existing system that is in place. And that's the reason that we're not in favor of changing the existing system.
And Mr. Chair, one more, please.
Follow up.
And Dash 3 doesn't change that.
That's correct. It does not change that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other testimony? Anyone? Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you. No. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2669 and open a work session on House Bill 2669. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2669.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2669. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2669 as amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2669 as amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation. Any discussion? Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Gilman. Aye.
Representative
Colby. Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Esteban.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carried. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would move 2669 as amended to the consent calendar. I just want to explain it on the floor.
Representative Shields would be glad to hear.
I do agree that because of the controversy around, somebody needs to explain it, and I guess it's my turn.
Answer your question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Shields. With that, the close the work session on House Bill 2669.
Mr. Chair, I neglected on that one to turn them up.
Okay.
There was at your place today a written testimony from Mr. McHale that will enter into the record.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, where are we at now? Too early, huh? What about 3017? Yeah. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3017.
Oh, good Lord, there's a back.
Who we got here?
It's just on the same testimony.
Yeah. I'm going to move everything in the work session.
We're going to move this bill to?
Yeah.
What's going to be longer than the graphic copy?
Proposition right there.
Oh,
yeah, that's not going to be. Okay. Janet, you want to explain House Bill 3017?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3017 removes a requirement that the six-month period that a contractor or subcontractor stays on a list of disqualified contractors because of late or non-payment for labor or materials on a public contract begins on the date the construction contractor's board received notice of the payment. The 60 days applies for the disqualification, and under current law it's confusing because if it begins on the date that DCBS received a complaint about non-payment, before they determine and have a hearing process and actually determine that there was non-payment, some of that 60 days would have already gone by. So the intent of 3017 is to have the 60-day disqualification begin when the DCBS orders the disqualification. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Jared?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association in support of House Bill 3017. It's a fairly simple concept. Like Janet explained, currently the way the law reads, when CCB receives the complaint, they then begin their investigation. And let's say it takes them 60 days, 6 months, whatever it is, to finish that investigation and then ultimately find an individual or contractor guilty or innocent. If they're found guilty and they would have been disbarred for, let's say, 6 months, and it took them 6 months to do the investigation and ultimately find that contractor guilty, well, the six-month period from the period when they received the information has already elapsed. So the time technically is already spent. So what we're doing here is trying to clarify the law to say that CCB can go through their investigation. When they make their determination whether it's guilty or innocent, if it's guilty, then that's when the period of time kicks in and starts. So it's just really clarification, and we had discussions with CCB during the interim that this was this needed clarified, and that's what we're attempting to do here.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. On the flip side of that, if you're innocent, you just continue on.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.
Jessica?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with AGC. We're here to just say that this entire law, the public prompt payment law, was passed in 1999 and was the product of what we would call very intense and lengthy negotiations between all the parties to try and get the law right. It appears that there were some confusions as we all felt that this law was problematic when it was put in place, put together in a piecemeal fashion, and that there are still, beyond the clarification here today, there are other problems with the prompt payment law. There's confusion in how to determine what the percentage of interest that you need to pay if you are late, how all of the pieces fit together, and it is quite an issue. If you get some public contracting attorneys in here, they'll go on for hours about the problems with this law, and I won't pain you with that discussion. But just to say, while the committee discusses this issue today, we would say that we have concerns on a broader scale, have concerns about just fixing just one part of the law when there is a need to really address the whole thing, and hope that this committee will be willing to entertain a broader look at the law come next session or at a future date to really fix up what is an important law, because contractors do need to pay their subs on time. That's an important component of the public contracting business. But at the same time, the law needs to be understandable and fair for everybody.
Thank you, Jessica. Any questions? Don't say any. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 3017? None. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3017 and open the work session on House Bill 3017. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3017 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3017 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to take into consideration the concerns that Jessica has raised, and would hope that whomever chairs the Business and Labor Committee during the interim takes on that broader task and reexamines these issues to make everything germane, and not just realizing that one person or one group brought forward this bill at this time, so we'll address it at this time, and I'm fine with that. But if there's a broader problem, I would encourage the chair, if he's the chair of this committee during the interim, which I hope that he is, so that I don't have to do it, that we do address those issues. So thank you,
Representative. Any other questions? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Pitts. Aye.
Representative Chalkwell.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilley.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
If this bill is not too controversial, or doesn't give the good representative from Portland too much heartburn, I would like to alleviate some of the hot air on the House floor and place it on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves that House Bill, 3017, be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, particularly if you're planning on giving it to Representative Kitts, I think that would be the best removal of hot air possible.
The 37,
the bus driver over here.
3017 is on the consent calendar.
Don't believe everything you read in Oregon.
Okay, where are we at now?
The amendments are being tabled. I didn't get up and talk about
it. Could you please?
Okay. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2525. Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2525, and we distributed the -1 amendments, but -2 amendments are being copied. They make a minor change. The original bill would have prohibited recovery in arbitration or court action for a construction defect if the homeowner rejected an offer from a contractor or subcontractor to remedy the defect. Mr. Chair, the 2003 legislature passed Senate Bill 909 that established a procedure for notice of a construction defect in a home as a prerequisite for either compelling arbitration or commencing court action to recover damages from the contractor. The bill established very specific notice requirements, allowances for visual inspections, and coordination of scheduling of inspections. And the bill was worked out among a variety of interest groups and the Construction Contractors Board. The bill did not contain a right of the contractor to fix or remedy the defect as a prerequisite to further action against the contractor. House Bill 2525 maintains the provisions of Senate Bill 909 and adds a requirement related to the right to remedy the defect. The -1 amendments and the -2 amendments contain the
same provisions provide that owners of new homes may reject an offer of remediation by a contractor and request an investigation and alternative dispute resolution by the construction contractor's board. The board may cover charge fees to cover their estimated costs also. And if the CCB is unable to resolve the defect by mediation, it may schedule a claim for a hearing. If a contested case hearing is not requested, the board may require the hearing be scheduled as binding arbitration. And it prohibits an owner who requests a CCB investigation from then filing an action or compelling arbitration to recover damages. For other than first owners of a home, it prohibits, as the original bill does, recovery in arbitration or court action if the owner rejects an offer from the contractor to fix the defect. So it's a split process, one for a new homeowner and one for a home second or third owner of a home. And the contractors can explain the reason for that difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Scott Berry, please.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I wanted to thank the committee administrator for kind of running through the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments this morning. Actually, this morning, I think what we have in terms of talking with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and with the Department of Justice, what we'd like to do is see if the committee wouldn't move the original House Bill 2525 this morning, which actually sets up the notice and right to cure process, allowing the contractor to come in and fix any problems that they agree are a construction defect, and then move on from there. So the original bill would allow the contractor, after the notice and opportunity to repair, to come in. An offer is made by the home builder to repair a certain number of items on that list. That list then would be turned back over to the general contractor, and those items would be repaired. If the homeowner rejected that, then they would not be able to then turn around and file suit on those items that the contractor agreed to repair. So what we'd like to do today is move that bill forward, and then if we need to, working with the Department of Justice and the trial lawyers, tweak the bill on the Senate side if that's what's required.
Thank you, Scott. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, my question, and I've stated this concern before, is I get a little nervous when we come here and say pass this bill and we'll just amend it on the Senate side, because then I'm voting for a bill that really is not the bill that I'm voting for. What are some of the potential concerns? I'm reading the bill, and the bill seems very simple. If I'm a contractor, I do a job, there's a defect in the job that I'm doing, and the owner of the structure that I'm working on comes back and says, this is a defect, this is poor quality, it's a defect, it's something's wrong. And the contractor says, well, I'm willing to fix it, and I'll put it in writing. And if the owner says, what if the owner says, well, I don't want you to fix it. You're the one that messed it up. Therefore, I'm rejecting that written offer. Now I can't sue. Is that I have no recourse?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, and that's exactly, I think, the reason we initially had some the Dash 1 amendments, was to try to solve that problem. Unfortunately, those tended to complicate and maybe even increase the expense to the consumer through discovery in the contested case hearing process that we set up. So what we'd like to do is maybe attempt to, I guess, tweak that, given the time constraints in the House, tweak that piece on the Senate to make sure we're not increasing the cost on the consumer, but giving them that second option and that out if they need it. And I think we're all in agreement on the necessity for that. The question just is how do we get there?
Follow up, if I might?
Follow up.
So what could be done in the Senate side that can't be done on the House side?
Again, Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I think the concern here is the time constraint we're under with the bill in the House and trying to get a workable product, which we think 2525 is today, a workable product over to the Senate side, and then fine-tuning it for the sending it back over here to the House for concurrence.
Okay. How much time do you need, sir?
Well, I guess I would maybe ask Christian Leonard, excuse me, with the OTLA to help me with that question.
For the record, Kristen Leonard with the Trial Lawyers Association. We have, I think what we would need is at least a week to have more, you know, kind of give us the time to look at how the Dash 1 amendments came out, whether or not this is close to earlier discussions we had, and come back with additional language. So if the committee felt like a week would be adequate amount of time for us to continue to work. Now, I don't know if that works out for the Department of Justice, but that would be enough time for us to kind of wrap our minds around the amendments. We just got them late yesterday. So.
Representative Escobar.
Well, it says in the Dash 1 amendments here that they have, and this is in conjunction with Senate Bill 909, which is new construction, I believe. And it lays out a certain pattern that you have to do, require a certain time frame on a difficult situation where you have a defect. But now, more importantly here, it also says that if they do not want the contractor to do it, they may reject the offer of to get it remedied by the contractor and request an investigation and alternative dispute resolution by the contractor's board. I want to know exactly what your hang-up is with that, because that gives them the option to, one, say, yay, you the contractor, you fix it, or B, no, I'm not going to, and I'll bring in the contractor for it. Am I reading this correct?
I don't know.
Go ahead. Chair Brown, Representative Escobar, yes, you are.
Well, then, I guess, please explain what you want to do to this at this point.
At this point in time, our concern is what this does to a consumer as it relates to cost. And so we're still trying to analyze if this sets in motion a cost burden for the consumer. We just want to spend some time making sure that we set in motion a process for kind of a scope of what the dispute is, what needs to be fixed, what this list looks like. And so that's what we're still working on, is some, you know, fine-tuning some of those elements. This was a process that, in theory, kind of was worked out between the Trial Lawyers Association and the home builders. What we're concerned about is the way the process is put together in the Dash 1 amendments. We're not sure it gets at all of our concerns. And that's what we'd like the time to work on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoenfer.
And thank you. You're all opposed, then, to us moving it out with the Dash 1.
The Trial Lawyers Association is opposed.
I think Scott Bear with the Oregon Home Builders Association. I think our interest is moving the bill forward, and we would like to move a bill forward that we're all agreeing on. Since I think, again, in concept we have an agreement, and I think in terms of agreement, our preference would be moving the original bill rather than the Dash ones.
Any other questions? Thank you. Can I have Craig Smith and Bill Boyd, please? Are these people here?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to be here before you. How can I help?
Help us with what needs to be done with it, I guess.
What I'm prepared to tell you today is that we've talked with home builders briefly about the concept of CCB interceding after what traditionally has been our 1 year statute of limitations, and working with folks that have problems with homes. We've got trained personnel who understand mediation between a consumer and a contractor. They're fairly adept at that job. They can do it pretty good. We've got hearings officers that are used to hearing these types of disputes. It's not free. There's costs involved. As we run the numbers, if you wanted this to be funded by user fees, we would estimate that the cost for the investigations would be between $300 and $400, and the cost of hearings would be between $1,500 and $2,000. Who pays that, whether that comes from contractors or consumers or a combination, general fund, whatever you want to do, probably is not going to come out of contractor licensing fees unless you so order.
Any questions? I guess no questions. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Could I have Kevin Neely and Eva Tayrose? Is that how you pronounce that?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kevin Neely from the Oregon Department of Justice, and Eva's back there, and she'll bail me out if I say anything incorrectly. I think that we have talked with Mr. Berry, and we've talked with Ms. Leonard of the Trial Lawyers Association. The Department of Justice opposes the bill as it's currently written. We oppose the -1 amendments, and we haven't seen the -2 amendments. I think that Representative Kitts hit on really one of the principal concerns of the Department of Justice, and that is those instances in which a consumer is so dissatisfied with the service that they've received from the contractor that they're unwilling to continue to have any sort of business relationship with them. And as the original bill is written, it would essentially preclude them from taking any action in court to remedy the situation if they disagreed with having the original contractor remedy the situation. And so, again, we think that places a burden on the consumer that is inappropriate, particularly in some instances if you have a contractor that may have repaired the problem 3, 4, 5 times. It may not be the case if there's just a simple error by the contractor. They can go in, they can remedy that. But again, I don't think those are the concerns we're worried about. The concerns that often come to our department are the concerns where you have either a significant amount of damage or you have, again, multiple abuses by a contractor. So we're comfortable working with the contractors on this. We're comfortable working with the trial lawyers. We're uncomfortable, as I said, with both the bill as it's written and the -1s. And I would add, Representative Esquivel has left, but I would add our concern, our fundamental concern with the -1 amendments is that essentially they do one good thing, and that is try to keep these processes out of the courtroom. I think that that's beneficial for the contractors and that's beneficial for the consumers, and certainly at the Department of Justice, we recognize that benefit. The problem is, as the -1s are written, they place the entire cost burden on the consumer. In order to open the door to the dispute resolution process, the consumer has to put up the money. They have to put up the money for the investigation. They have to put up the money for the arbitration or the mediation. And additionally, the thing we need to remember is, in most of these instances, as a consumer is going through the process, they also get an attorney to help represent them, certainly depending on the scope of the damages. So now you have foisted upon the consumer all of those costs, with none of those costs borne by the contractors. So those are really our fundamental concerns. Again, I think if there's some sort of way that we can move these processes out of the courtroom, but put the consumer and the contractor on equal footing, that would be the ideal situation for the department. We are admittedly a little bit late in the game here. We did work when we first saw the bill with the contractors, haven't worked with them a lot since then, and we're not part of the work group that worked on the -1s. I think we're more than happy to participate in some sort of work group, and depending on whether or not you folks want to move this over to the other side or keep it here, we will agree to abide by whatever timeline you put on us, as always. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Just for the record, sir, you can only repair something once. You can go there 5 or 6 times and muck it up, but you can only repair it once. That means it's repaired. I just wanted to get that squared away. You can't repair something 3 or 4 times. It wasn't repaired the first 2 or 3 times. But I agree with the concept where the builders are trying to get here. I mean, but is it constitutional to make it so that you deny someone the ability to go to court? They're not trying to do that. They are offering some kind of recourse. If you hate the guy or gal, go to the next contractor. But if we went it out just as the bill is, I think that may not... I mean, is that a constitutional question, to deny someone's day in court?
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, that's a good question. I admittedly haven't looked at that closely, and I'm not going to give you a definitive answer as to whether or not there's a constitutional flaw there. I do know that there are certainly instances in the law that do preclude certain types of action. It's kind of a, if you haven't taken step A, you can't take step B. But again, I think that's something that we can look into for you without any problem. I'm sure one of the more knowledgeable attorneys at our office, in fact, someone who is an attorney, since I'm not, would be able to answer that question in short order, and I can get that answer back for you.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify too, I have no problem with this concept at all, and I do have reservations about moving it, but if we do move it, I refuse to carry it on the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2525. Where are we at now? And is John here?
They're going to be watching the TV.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3462. And Janet, can you... get us up to speed.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3462 would extend the Jobs Plus program by transferring unemployment insurance taxes to the Oregon Jobs Plus Unemployment Wage Fund for calendar years 2006 through 2012. And it specifies that eligibility for the Jobs Plus program is limited to persons who receive benefits for no more than 8 weeks under current claim benefits and earn less than $15 an hour from the person's last employer before filing the claim. It allows the Employment Department to waive the 8-week limit for up to 10% of unemployment insurance recipients and declares an emergency and takes effect on passage. Mr. Chair, what I forgot to note at the staff member summary is that this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Mark Kane, please? Was there someone else also with you, Mark?
Yeah, Joe Spendolini from Simon Falls is also.
Okay, Joe, please.
I didn't anticipate that you were going to bring me first.
Chairman Brown and members of the committee.
Excuse me just a minute, okay. Mark.
That's right.
Representative Lim has come in. Representative, would you like to join them up there?
Yes. Thank you very much, Chair.
And we'll start with Representative Lim then.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, glad to see you here. And my name is John Lim, a state representative from District 50, which is Gresham area. I'm very happy to be here to testify on the House Bill 3462, was it?
Yeah.
Yes, 3462. When I was serving as a state senator, 1993, I was one of the co-sponsors of the Jobs Plus bill. At the time that the people on welfare roll was, if I remembrance is correct, it's around 100,000 people. Too many people are takers instead of givers, because out of that concern and that we were able to introduce Jobs Plus bill, creating more jobs, giving them opportunity to work. instead of staying on welfare. Many people stayed on welfare role because it's better than working on minimum wage. And that had to be changed, and we did. After we passed the Jobs Plus bill, that the welfare role has been dropped in 3 years to half, which is 50,000. Right now, I think we are at about the same level. So Jobs Plus bill has been working. That was not the complete solution of the unemployment issues in our state, but that has been one of the big things that created more jobs and opportunities to work. Jobs Plus program has been and continues to be a useful tool in solving this serious employment problem, while at the same time encouraging the creation of new jobs throughout the entire economy. All participants are paid the same wages as any other working the same job with their employers. The employer are given $5 an hour wage subsidy to offset the cost of training and orienting the new employee, and in some cases to encourage an employer to take on a more challenging employee than the employer might otherwise have employed. Statistical reports that I have reviewed indicate that Jobs Plus program is not only an effective program in putting people to work, but its effectiveness is clear when we review the outcomes a year after the program. At that point, 68% of the participants continued in employment. That rate is much higher than for claimants that did not participate in the program. Thousands of people have benefited from this Jobs Plus program, and thousands of employers have also participated in providing employment. Surveys have indicated satisfaction with both participants and employers. Most employers support the reauthorization of this program. Jobs Plus put people back to work and provides on the job training, helps encourage job creation, and is good for economic development. Jobs Plus provide individual training fund for participants for future job skill enhancement and growth. I believe in Jobs Plus. It should be reauthorized. This is why I have made it one of my priority bills and encourage all my colleagues to support House Bill 3462. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? I don't see any.
Right.
Mark, go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Representative.
Chairman Brown and members of the committee, thank you for today's opportunity to testify before you on behalf of House Bill 3462. Since the session began in January, I've been meeting with legislators to discuss the importance of reauthorizing the diversion from the Unemployment Trust Fund of funds that will be necessary for the Jobs Plus program for unemployment claimants to continue into the next year. I've also met with many legislative staff, representatives of the Employment Department, at least two of the department's separate advisory councils, the staff of other departments that relate to the Jobs Plus program, including three members of the governor's staff, local administrators and staff, union representatives, and most importantly, with some of the participants who have benefited from the Jobs Plus program. The chairman of one of our local jobs advisory councils, Joe Spendolini, and sitting next to me is here today to offer testimony and will be able to relate how the program performs in the field if you wish to ask him those questions. As I embraced my assignment to achieve the passage of this bill, it seemed to me that it would be a task easily accomplished, as on the surface and throughout, the program is just plain good sense. Who would oppose a program that uniquely acquires operating support from other than the general fund to support placement and training of individuals currently unable to find work and who truly, like all of us, need to have an opportunity for productivity? Surprisingly, I have discovered substantial opposition among the ranks of those you would least expect to find it, in the Employment Department itself and among employee unions, both of which are charged with overseeing the well-being of people in achieving satisfactory employment. As I explored the opposition, one official took me aside and stated, "You just don't get it." Well, I've considered all the facts and applied the nearly 33 years of experience I have in the development and administration of employment programs for people with all kinds of challenges in finding and holding employment. There's no question in my mind that I get it, and I'd like to share with you what I get. Large numbers of people remain unemployed in the state of Oregon. And while some are celebrating the fact that the state's unemployment numbers are approaching the national average, I think to myself, why are we celebrating average? Where's the pride in mediocrity? And I'm reminded that in some counties, the percentages remain above 10%. People, large numbers of them, remain in need of employment. 40,000 unemployment claimants a year exhaust their benefits after 6 months or as many as 9 months. The proposed authorization of the Jobs Plus program would allow us to service 1 in 10 of those exhaustees, not to mention other claimants as well. Unemployment has a devastating effect on people and families, while employment encourages individuals and families to grow. Research from numerous sources show that when employment is taken away, people become susceptible to depression, cardiovascular disease, AIDS, and many other illnesses. In fact, unemployment causes people to be twice as likely to become clinically depressed. Compared to those employed full-time, twice as many of the employed said they were currently unemployed said they were currently drug users. A rise in unemployment of 1% correlated to an increase of nearly 500,000 crimes in the United States. And what about our children? Children whose parents are unemployed are at higher risk of emotional and behavioral problems. The longer that conditions of unemployment lasted has been correlated to a decrease in the intelligence of children of the unemployed. On the brighter side, researchers found these results. Parental employment reduced children's behavioral problems, increased positive social behavior, and improved overall children's health. In young adults suffering from depression, employment causes high recovery rates, and working in it is an integral part of treating substance abuse. So you see, it's not just about individuals, but about children and families as well. Some have complained that the reemployment of nearly 7,000 people through the Jobs Plus program for unemployment claimants since its last reauthorization just isn't enough. On the contrary, I was thinking about the benefit to all the others as well. I was thinking that we get too caught up in statistics and not thinking enough about the value of each job, one person at a time, and all the people that each of those newly employed folks might influence. Individuals and families experiencing higher, healthier lives because of employment and its related benefits reminded me not only of the value of wages earned and the impact on the economy, but also about the value of services that would not be required, services provided by other entities that consume state general funds. You've all sat through hearings with all the human services agencies begging for additional funds while you are trying to determine which services are of more value than another. Here's an opportunity to reduce the burden on many of those other services and the need for additional general fund support with funding from another source. I have followed newspaper reports about the economy over recent weeks. In February, the Oregonian reported that nationally employment had slowed to a crawl and that the percentage of those employed as a part of the labor force was at its lowest point since 1988. My first reaction was, well, what about Oregon? So a few days later, another front page article reported that Oregon was experiencing its highest level of employment in its history. That was by raw numbers, however, as the rate of unemployment was still at 6.5%, a point and a half higher than pre-recession rates. And since I have read about job expansion in service industries, manufacturing, and more, some will take parts of this data to tell you there is no longer a need for Jobs Plus, as people are being hired. But I ask, who is being hired? Are they those with little experience and need for additional training? Are they those that appear to employers to be the most qualified? I suspect that's where the employers will go. I interpret the news to say that the economy is growing and the time couldn't be better to get challenging employees on the job. But I also believe that employers won't take them without a little assistance. The employment of the most challenged will have the greatest impact on individuals, families, other service budgets, and the health of the community in general. We have an excellent tool to provide that assistance, and it shouldn't be removed from the Employment Department's toolbox. Some have suggested that we have better, more effective, and more efficient methods. Perhaps there are, but there is no one-size-fits-all tool. Many tools are required to meet the diverse needs of those challenged with unemployment. The Jobs Plus program needs to be one of them. This is no time to be throwing away the tools. Concerns have been expressed by unions over reauthorization, even though the program is just as likely to expand unionized and non-unionized positions. It is, in fact, implemented by unionized public employees. This shouldn't be about partisan politics or about union opinions. This is about not settling for mediocrity, either in the level of employment or in the way we go about employing people. This is about the value of work. This isn't just about individuals, but about their children. This isn't just about children, but whole families. This isn't just about families, but whole communities and the opportunity to participate and contribute to community life rather than to be perceived as a burden on your community. This is about the opportunity to support oneself, personal responsibility, and human dignity. On April 14th, I was visiting with some participants of the Jobs Plus program in Klamath Falls, and this is what I heard from one woman. She was employed by Diamond Supply 2 years ago and still on the job now, almost 2 years after the training subsidy to her employer has ended. She couldn't say enough positive things about the impact on her life. Without solicitation, she went on to say more. Part of her work assignment now is to be a mentor to other Jobs Plus employees who are coming into employment with Diamond Supply. She also spoke to the positive impact her employment has had and continues to have on her children. They have a different view now of the need for education and training and of the value of employment itself. She testified to the improved health of her family in general because of her own individual employment and its impact on others in her life. She accepted my being proud of her, but more importantly, embraced her own well-earned pride in herself. She and her family are on the way. She was just one of many who could tell similar stories. The Jobs Plus program, like any other, will have its flaws and needs for improvement. They shouldn't be caused to eliminate the program, but to make it better. At its last reauthorization, there was severe criticism leveled at the program as one that makes low-wage earners out of higher-wage earners. This session's bill has a provision to correct that by only requiring the participation of those who earned less than $15 an hour prior to their current claim for benefits. There have been challenges as to whether the cost of the program is less than the cost of a 26 or 39-week benefit claim. This session's bill aims to lower that cost by requiring replacement within the first 8 weeks of unemployment benefits. The Sessions bill also calls for enough funds to more than double the number of claimants to be placed to help alleviate concerns about administrative efficiencies. It can be a better program and will be with your vote for reauthorization. 1 in 10 employed Oregonians will file an unemployment claim this year. That's a lot of Oregonians looking for work. And in many cases, some additional assistance to regain their reentry into the workplace. They want to go back to work because they know the best place to learn is on the job, and they know the value of work itself. You may hear much about the efficiency of one program compared to another. When you do, ask about all the costs and all the benefits. When Jobs Plus is put into play, the trust fund is relieved of the burden of a claimant's benefits, averaging $256 per week, in many cases much more. While for the next 13 weeks, the employer is given a subsidy of up to $200 a week. Yes, there's an administrative cost associated with this that may run as high as $52 for each of those 13 weeks. When the 13 weeks have ended, the subsidy drops to zero, the administrative cost is complete, and the worker is earning a wage while there is no further draw on the trust fund. This is, as they say, a fiscal no-brainer, despite the fact that the employer has benefited by the receipt of a well-deserved subsidy to his training costs. The benefits are numerous. Released just this last month was a new compendium of long-term research results of Job Training and Workforce Investment Act, which was reviewed in the Upjohn Institute's Employment Research Journal. Here are some of the results. Job training effectiveness varies widely with respect to different demographic groups of participants. My conclusion, retain many tools that can adapt to the diverse training and support demands of the unemployed. That includes the Jobs Plus program. The biggest gains were observed when on-job training was combined with job search assistance. Inclusion, maintain the availability of programs like the Jobs Plus program that offer on-the-job training with opportunities for job search. On-the-job training combined with job search had larger impacts than classroom training, although community college training in math and science yielded the greatest earnings gains. Conclusion, maintain programs like Jobs Plus that provide both on-the-job training with an individual training account to be utilized by the participant in a manner that is responsive to their personal learning style. Bottom line, evaluation studies have found that combining work experience with job training tends to produce better labor market success. The Jobs Plus program should remain in the toolbox along with others that prove themselves to be efficient and effective. And finally, a pause for thought on something I recently heard from a well-known national leader. There is no freedom without the opportunity for employment. You'll find attached to your copy of my testimony an updated summary sheet similar to the talking piece I've been distributing to legislators since January. Source notes are included on the reverse side as an improvement to information distributed earlier in the session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for your attention and the opportunity to testify. I'll remain here if you have questions.
Thank you, Mark. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I will be a no on this because I haven't been. I was one of the people that Mr. Kane met with several times.
Thank you.
You know, that's quite all right. It hasn't been shown to me that statistically this is as effective as when we put our money into the employment department, especially when they add extra training, we take the extra $5. It's been shown to me statistically that they can be more effective with this money. That's not really what I'm going to comment on, Mr. King. I am very disappointed in you and your testimony. I'm offended. You come in here and you bash unions. You come in here and suggest that if I vote for this, I'm against working people and working families. I know there's been success stories in this program, and I'm grateful for that. And I know it's not perfect, and I know the employment department isn't perfect. But to come in here and suggest that to vote against this is a no-brainer, it implies that I have no brains if I vote no on it. And to suggest that I'm against freedom and working families, Mr. Kane, I'm sorry, I am very upset. Very disappointed in you and your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, it was not my intent to offend you in any way. It's been pretty clear in my speaking with union representatives that you're clearly against the program and you're entitled to your opinion. So.
Joe, would you like to give your testimony, please?
Chairman Brown and members of the committee, my name is Joe Spendolini. I'm the chair of the Klamath and Lake County Jobs Plus Council, and I'm here to ask you to approve the Jobs Plus Reauthorization Bill, House Bill 3462. The Jobs Plus program is a vital program in assisting our unemployed citizens to gain employment. One attractive aspect of the program is that it promotes the hiring of individuals by businesses that might not entirely meet the requirements of the position. The Jobs Plus program is funded outside the general fund by UI dollars and administered by the Employment Department. Though the program does not directly impact the general fund, the effects of unemployment on the general fund can be significant. We're all aware of the link between unemployment, depression, domestic violence, substance abuse, and crime in general. These areas do have an impact on the general fund. The Jobs Plus program is designed to move individuals from the unemployment rolls into employment. I understand the number of participants in the Jobs Plus program has declined, and that some may view that as a reflection of the value we should place in the program. Though I have no hard data to provide you, I offer you my personal observations. The UI Jobs Plus program shares its name with a similar program administered by AFS. A few years ago, funding was removed from the AFS Jobs Plus program. Unfortunately, this had a negative effect on the UI Jobs Plus program, as the general public, including business, only heard the news that the Jobs Plus program had been eliminated. To this day, I encounter individuals and businesses that believe the Jobs Plus program doesn't exist. Nearly every day in my community, I have to explain that the Jobs Plus program is still available. Because of the confusion caused by the temporary elimination of the AFS Jobs Plus program, an intense program needs to be launched designed to educate the business community and the workforce that the Jobs Plus program is still alive. The Jobs Plus program administered by the Employment Department is a program that saves that department money. The average benefits paid to UI claimants is about $252 a week. Most are eligible to receive those benefits for 26 weeks unless they are granted an extension. Now, 45% will exhaust their benefits. The Jobs Plus program pays $200 a week or approximately $50 less than that for 12 weeks and are not part of the benefits extensions that have been given. When you calculate the lower payout of Jobs Plus and add that to the extension of benefits not paid out to Jobs Plus participants, the savings is enormous. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today, and I remain for questions if you like.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shields.
Thanks for coming. Mark, the 68% that you mentioned compared to the 58% job retention, right. Is that 68% actually stay on the jobs with those employers that they started out the program with?
It's my understanding that the 68% relates to being on a job, any job.
Mm-hmm.
And so a piece of information that was provided by the Employment Department. So that's measured at 12 months after the completion of the program, which would be 15 months after you begin your job.
Okay, 12 months. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Okay. 12 months from when they go on off the company's... So the employer of record is actually the company where they're working, not the Jobs Plus program.
So the 68% was... When we first started talking with people, we were reporting that 80% remained on the job at the end of the training period, which was 13 weeks. Many legislators asked about effectiveness, and the effectiveness question was referenced to, well, where are they a year later?
Mm-hmm.
So 12 months after the completion of the training is where the 68% statistic comes from, which is a significant number.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Any other questions? Representative Escobar.
I think on this program that within 30 days, you're going to know whether you keep this individual. Trust me. I mean, there are people out there that do not want to work, no matter what you do. Then there's other people that just want a chance. And I think this program gives them a chance if you educate the private sector to utilize this program.
That's true. And I might point out, Ms. Chair, Representative Esquivel, even though the program in this bill is targeted to people that are earning less than $15 prior to the claim, does not preclude others who earned more from participating if they choose to, and I suspect many will, because they value work.
Is the authorization for this program is about to expire or has expired?
Well, it was last reauthorized in 2001, I guess. Not last session, but prior to that. And it continues, as I understand it, until the presently allocated funds are exhausted. So it was anticipated that would be at the end of this fiscal year, but it may go beyond that. And those are technical questions you should probably ask of Mrs. Lincoln. So.
Any other questions?
Last question. And you may have told me this in the meetings that we had previously, Mark, but my question is regarding cost per participant after the whole ball of wax is completed. Do we have a number on that?
Well, as I indicated in Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, as I indicated in my testimony, it's $5 per hour worked, so it's tied to the actual hours worked of the participant. So that's $200 a week at 40 hours. The administrative costs for this program are reported to be at $666 per participant. And so coincidentally, if you divided that by 13, you'd get about $52 or so, which compares almost identically to the cost of an average claim per week. So from that point of view, you might think of it as a wash. So plus, then you have the savings of not paying out benefits beyond the 13 weeks of training.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
Can I have Lisa Trussell, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell, representing the members of AOI, and we're here today to offer our support to House Bill 3462. We believe it provides the Employment Department another tool to help unemployed individuals return to work. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Lisa? Lisa, to your knowledge, is there any other programs out there to help these people?
Well, the Employment Department has a wonderful website that's also available, and I believe the website is imatchskills.com or org. They'll know. But and that's a tool where an employer can go on online and enter a work order, and the Employment Department can match. The claimants can go on online, and they can match that way. Had a demonstration of that program several months ago. In fact, I think it was before the session started when they first launched it, and that's another tool available as well. And then I think you can do the traditional stops, and I believe that the one stops are part of the Employment Department's plans too.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions? Do not see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have Debbie Lincoln and Tim Nesbitt and Gwen Harvey, please? Start with you, Debbie, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm members of the committee. I'm Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. The Oregon Employment Department has implemented the Jobs Plus program for the last 10 years. In 2001, it was significantly changed. We've been implementing it for the last 4 years. We did not include a request for additional funding in the governor's recommended budget. We don't think the program is effective enough to justify the cost. If we were to continue the program, we would have to divert another $12 million per year, a total of over $100 million the next few years from the state unemployment trust account, which would generate a tax increase for employers and would eat into the tax reduction that you passed in House Bill 2127 fairly significantly. I do have... I'm sorry, I should have given this to her first. I think many of you have seen this, but she's right there, too. Thanks. Information that indicates that the program itself is not used well either by businesses or by claimants. We have information that only less than 2% of businesses have used this program, even though every employer pays for it. Less than 1% of claimants have taken advantage of this program. If the Employment Department were a business and this were a product line, it would have been gone a long time ago because of the high cost and the low customer acceptance of it. The cost itself, the high cost, is due to the need to do some fairly intensive case management and job development for this program. One of the limiting factors is that we can't find Jobs Plus placements. Employers aren't interested in providing these kinds of placements, and we have to have... if we were to meet the 4,000 placement rate that the proponents envision, we would have to have 10,000 job listings in order to do that. It's about a 40% placement rate. I think I will, at this point, ask turn it over to the other two speakers. I'd be happy to answer questions on specific technical pieces. But overall, the Employment Department does not support the bill and does not support the program.
Gwen, why don't we go to you next?
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Gwen Harvey. I am a private human resources consultant here in Oregon. I have a 30-year career in business, primarily technology industry. I also serve as chair of the Employment Advisory Council, an advisory body to Debbie Lincoln, which is comprised of management, public, and labor representatives, so it's a joint interest body. I also serve as the chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, again, a body that is comprised of business, labor, and public members from all around our state. I'm here to talk to you today in opposition to this bill. In particular, I've had the opportunity to kind of look at Jobs Plus from its early days to where we are today, looked at data from the Employment Department that shows that it is a high-cost program. The return on the investment is low. As Debbie stated, in a business environment, were this a division, a product line, or whatever, it would not still be with us. We can't justify it. We also had an opportunity to hear from Mark Brown from Higher Calling at a recent Employment Advisory Council meeting, so we took the opportunity to hear the other side so that we could talk about this and make sure our members were informed before we took a vote on this matter as to whether to support or oppose this bill. When we took a vote on this particular bill, by more than a majority, we opposed this bill, and we took that stand publicly. It's a matter of public record. We talked about, in particular, why does the UI Trust Fund exist? It exists to pay benefits to claimants who, through no fault of their own, find themselves temporarily unemployed. Businesses pay these payroll taxes that fund the trust fund that allow us to pay out these benefits. As Debbie mentioned, a bill just recently went through that is going to provide businesses with over $200 million in payroll savings over the next few years. That's a huge economic investment we're making in this state, both for businesses and for workers. Were we to advance Jobs Plus to its next phase, we would see that greatly eroded. And in fact, it's highly likely employers would experience a UI tax rate increase as a result of an additional tap on the UI trust fund. That will not set well with businesses. Yes, unemployment is still not where we'd like it to be. We'd like it to be lower. Businesses are seeing some improvements, but we're still seeing some businesses leave or reduce their employee roles here in this state. So they don't need disincentives to stay here in Oregon. They need incentives. That $200 million means a lot to them, small, medium, and large-sized businesses. I also want to mention to you that we all know resources are declining. You all are faced with some tough choices when it comes to the budget and what we do with the monies we do have. I think we have to be prudent and strategic about our investments, and Jobs Plus doesn't warrant being a strategic investment for the state of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Gwen. Tim, you go ahead.
Please. Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing in opposition to House Bill 3462. Our bases for opposing the bill and the continuation of the program as proposed in the bill are four, really. One is how it's funded. The other is its impact on the finances of our unemployment insurance system, as well as the tax that supports that system. Thirdly, its track record as a job placement program compared to the track record of other job placement programs run by the Employment Department. And fourthly, its track record as a cost-effective subsidy to create jobs. I'll touch on each of the four, but I want to start by agreeing with one central point of Mark Kane's testimony. He asked you to, quote, consider all the costs and all the benefits. And we'd urge you to do the same. Let me begin first with this point. Number one, the Jobs Plus program as structured as subsidies to employers is not a legal use of unemployment insurance trust funds or unemployment insurance tax revenues under federal law. That's why you're talking about a diversion. That's why it's always been funded by diversion. But let's be honest, a diversion is really a gimmick. It's an accounting gimmick. It means that you reduce the payroll tax which employers pay to support unemployment insurance benefits and substitute for that reduction an equal amount of tax going for a different purpose. That's a diversion. We think if ever there is a diversion, it needs to pass a pretty high test, pretty high threshold for cost effectiveness. And again, we don't think this program does. Secondly, look at your unemployment insurance program as it is structured now under the law. It's been a success. We have one of the best funded, best managed, and successful programs in the country. And proof of that is over the last 3 years, during the recession, you voted, by the way, in both chambers with never a dissenting vote, to extend unemployment insurance benefits a total of 4 times. And you were able to do that with the funds in the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, which was sufficient to support those extensions without having to raise, at the time, without having to raise employer payroll taxes. That's a success story. Other states have gone to the bank and been borrowing money during the recession. We've managed to maintain a balance because we've been holding on to the integrity of the fund to support our unemployment insurance benefits, including extensions during recessions when they're needed most. So I want to thank you all, by the way, in the past sessions, including this session, for voting for those extensions. But I want to remind you that the reason you're able to do that without raising employer costs is because we've been strict about keeping this fund dedicated to the purposes of supporting unemployment insurance benefits for unemployed workers. Thirdly, actually, as part of my second point here in terms of impact, let's look at all the costs and all the benefits, including the secondary costs. Well, here you have a diversion that will amount to $106 million that would otherwise go to that trust fund supporting the core benefits over the next 7 years. You right now will be operating under a very tight margin. Employer rates are supposed to go down, but those calculations are pretty tight in terms of when, by formula, if we experience higher than expected unemployment or higher than expected claims, you're going to be triggering further employer rate increases because the system is funded with a self-sustaining formula. Right now, there's a very tight margin. If you divert $106 million from this program, from the revenues that flow to the trust fund over the next 7 years, by year two, by 2007, you'll be triggering an employer rate increase that otherwise wouldn't trigger. And that employer rate increase will amount to $89 million a year. So, in effect, you'd be taking $106 million out of the pot, or technically out of the money that's now flowing to support our benefits, and then forcing employers to come up with another $88 million to make up for it. Thirdly, I want to challenge some of the assumptions about costs and benefits. On the benefits side, this program has a much higher administrative cost than other placement programs run by the Employment Department, in excess of $2,500 per claimant. For every $5 you pay in subsidy under this program to an employer, there's another $1.50 just to administer the program. That's a much higher administrative overhead cost than you see in the basic employment placement programs run by the Employment Department, where for other claimants in the system, the cost is $731, not $2,657 per placement. Thirdly, we do see only a slightly higher continued employment rate after 1 year with the Jobs Plus placements versus the others. It's 68% versus 64% if you want to compare apples to apples. And there are other programs in the Employment Department which have targeted assistance to certain kinds of claimants which do better than 68%. You also see a reduction in average earnings 1 year out from the earnings that the claimants had before they entered, at the time they were laid off. Finally, I think we really have to question whether the job creation part of this really works. To subsidize and help create jobs that otherwise wouldn't be created, or subsidize jobs which are being created by market forces in any case. And if you look at the printout, which I've seen from the Employment Department, about the kinds of employers and the kinds of jobs which are funded here, one that caught my attention was when Cirque du Soleil came to town and set up their tents a couple years ago. Guess what? We paid a lot of subsidies to workers who helped set up the tents. I think they would have done that anyway. I think those jobs would have been there anyway. And I'm not sure that was a cost-effective use of our tax dollars. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
I have several questions, but I will, after each one, I will ask for a follow-up by the time. Can you tell me what Sitel is? It's the number two recipient of Jobs Plus.
Mr. Chair, I cannot... we think it's a high-tech employer, and we'll certainly find out. Can have you do that?
Follow-up? Excuse me. I'm looking through the top 15 recipients here, and I see City Center Parking. I'm assuming that that's probably not the CEO of City Center, probably the lot attendant that's parking cars or taking your money. as you're there. And Safeway, I think probably the same thing is probably true in box boys, helper clerks, that sort of thing. My question in pointing those things out, what percentage, and I don't know if you have any way of determining this, what percentage of that total number of the 2450, mm-hmm. what percentage of those are minimum wage jobs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, I can't give you the actual percentage. It's very, very high, though. A $5 per hour subsidy doesn't go very far if you're over minimum wage.
Follow-up? The 13, and I want to make sure that I'm understanding this properly. I'm looking at your second bullet point on the front page. The Employment Department Jobs Plus program subsidizes 13 weeks of work experience at $5 an hour. Excuse me. I can't talk with that thing in. I know. I'm not leaving it in.
We vote on that.
You can laugh. It's okay. That 13 weeks, if I'm utilizing the program and I bring somebody in and you're subsidizing them for 13 weeks at the $5 an hour, is there anything that stops me from just bring me another one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, no, there's nothing that stops you from churning through, and we suspect that happens. One of the issues we have with the program, the way it's been run, is that we do not have the capability of auditing to ensure that the kinds of jobs that are being offered are brand-new jobs, which are required, or that people don't simply use it churn through. We also can't audit the amount of training people get. We did a survey last spring and found that only 68% of the people who participated in Jobs Plus got any training at all, and this is supposed to be a training program. And most of that training was the follow Joe around kind of training. So to get at the kinds of questions you're asking, we would have to put some money toward an audit function.
One final follow-up, please. Then I'll put my retainer back in. The concern that I'm having at this point is I'm seeing the potential here for the abuse of a program such as this, where you have a temp agency using the state as a temp agency, essentially through subsidies, and that seems to be my biggest concern, especially since these are, I think Mr. Nesbitt makes a good point when he says you're going to need box boys anyway. You're going to need people to take the money at the parking structure anyway. So are we really transitioning in people into the workforce? And are they, like you bring up the training aspect, it's not rocket science to bag groceries. Don't put the eggs on the bottom. You know, I mean, it's not rocket science. Even I did it. So it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is that not defeating the intended purpose? If our purpose is to bring people in that are unemployed, subsidize a $5 per hour for what appears to be an inadequate enough time to get trained to learn the craft or whatever it is that you're doing. But if somebody's bagging groceries at $7 and whatever our ever-increasing minimum wage is these days, and they're getting a $5 per hour subsidy of that, that's not really... Would you say that's defeating the purpose, the intended purpose of this program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, yes, I would, and that's exactly why we don't support the continuation of the program.
Thank you.
Question. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, on educating people on this particular program, whose responsibility is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, we do it in two different ways. The current law requires us to provide information to every claimant that walks in the door and give them the opportunity to develop a Jobs Plus placement on their own. We also have staff who are in contact with businesses all the time as we take regular job listings, and those people continually provide information to the businesses directly on Jobs Plus. It's also an option on our unmatched skills system, the system that Lisa talked about.
Follow up.
I see Master Brand Cabinets is on here, and that's a Grants Pass firm. I utilized this program when I was in Josephine County. Not one time in Jackson County was I ever approached on this program by the Employment Department. So the lack of education, some of that has to lay at your feet.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, you're absolutely right. As you can see, the cost is high. One thing that if we were to implement House Bill 3462, particularly as written, and aim for that 4,000-person placement, we would have to put on a much more intensive job development, employer contact effort, and a more intensive marketing effort, which we can do, but at a cost.
Any other questions? Representative Shield.
As somebody who's worked in job placement before, particularly with the Workforce Investment Act and its predecessor, the Jobs Training Department Partnership Act, the $2,600 per placement probably is not that high compared to other providers, but I just want to make sure that all the costs are in that $2,600. That probably wouldn't include any of the costs of, say, one of the temp agencies who kind of acts as the go-between to different employers. So their marketing costs wouldn't be included in this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Can you tell me, I know that this program probably changed a great deal since it was originally started about probably 10 years ago. And the intent then, I know the program was to move people from welfare to work. And by and large, the people you've seen there were single moms with kids. And is there any kind of a program within the employment department or even within the unions to help these people move from there, or do we just leave them on welfare now?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Jobs Plus Human Resources program is still in place. The Department of Human Services has a Jobs Plus program that it provides 26 weeks of employment at minimum wage with some assistance for benefits for people who are in the jobs program. It's temporary assistance to needy families. So that program is in place. It's not going anyplace. It's funded with a mix of federal and general fund. So we work with DHS to place people who come out of the jobs program. The Jobs Plus program itself is a very small percentage of the overall jobs program, but it is in place and it is available to get those people off welfare.
Your comment said it's not going any place. You mean it's going to stay in place, or you're doing something?
Mr. Chairman, it is. It's going to stay in place. There's no effort to discontinue the Jobs Plus program in DHS.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You brought up some interesting points, and one of my concerns was, and sort of what I'm hearing is there really isn't a connection between this program and the creation of jobs, but what there is a connection is that this program borrows from 98% of the other employers, or actually borrows from the unemployment trust funds that 98% of the other employers have put in, and gives a $5 subsidy to the 2% of employers, and in so doing reduces the trust funds available for unemployment insurance to workers that are out of work. And so I'm not really seeing a connection between their job creation with this program, and so that does cause me a lot of concern. Is that, are you seeing that in the same light, and is that why you're, another reason why you're considering ending this program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbert, that's an excellent summary of our concerns. Yes, we don't see the kinds of job creation that will sustain families into the future or lead to high-wage jobs through this program, and that concerns us.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And we have, that goes to the list of people signed up to testify. Was there anyone else here to testify on 3462? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3462. And we had three other items on the agenda, the 3319, 3256, and 2525, and the that we've heard, and I wanted to move today, but we don't have the amendments, so my understanding is the Speaker's office will let us handle them Monday. And so with that,
do this again next week.
Anything else, Janet? No. Okay, with that, we're adjourned.